Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today marks Just the Best Literature's 100th program. It's just hard to imagine we actually completed 100 programs. To celebrate this event, I wanted to share some highlights from some of the coolest, or at least what I think is the coolest, of the last 99 programs. I thoroughly enjoyed doing this broadcast. I really deeply appreciate my producer, Mr. Joshua Sloan. I have learned and experienced so much that I'm looking forward to doing the next 100. While most people my age are actually hoping to retire, I was offered a challenge to do something I had never done before, host a radio program. I was excited, a little nervous, but decided to jump right in. Hey, welcome to our first program here on KPCG.FM. Before we get into today's program, I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about myself. Certainly you want to know who I am and why you should listen to me. Well, I have a bachelor's degree in English literature and a master's degree in library and information science. Now, what does all that mean? Well, as an undergraduate, I focused my studies in 18th and 19th century English poetry, and I also studied 20th century American authors. Also, as part of my undergraduate degree, I concentrated on poetry writing. Now, from my master's degree, I concentrated on resources and bibliography, which is kind of just a fancy name for becoming a reference librarian. I was trained to do research for, let's say the geology department, or trained to do research for the chemistry department. I mean, I was trained to be like the book hound that went and hunted things down for people. But during my career of 40 years, and really it just seems like yesterday to me, I've been an assistant director for a 9-branch county library system in the Pacific Northwest. I worked for Westinghouse Electric Corporation for 14 years. I worked in their information services department. It was in that department I served as a technical writer. I was also a technical librarian. I was the assistant director of the corporation's technical communications committee. I really had the opportunity to travel all over the United States with that job. And then I was also a ghostwriter for company executives, and that means some of their presidents. Hey, but what am I doing right now? Well, I'm senior writer and editor for the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, also the Royal Vision magazine, and both of these magazines are produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. You could read my articles if you'd like on thetrumpet.com or at thetrumpet.com and also at pcog.org. I also teach English language literature and Shakespeare here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. And most important of all, I'm Irish, which gives me the gift of gab.
Well, how's that for humility? Of course, all Irish people are humble. All joking aside, I was earnest about the goal for JBL. I wanted people in the far-flung places on the earth who have access to the internet to belong to a book club and begin reading great books. In our modern high-tech world, people are losing sight of the art of reading and the importance of reading. Reading feeds our minds, it stimulates our thinking, and it literally keeps our minds in great health.
I would like you to consider this program as, well, the biggest international book club you could ever become a part of. But here's the real benefit. There's no membership fee for you. However, I am going to ask you to buy some books. I'm also going to ask you to read some books because on this program, we're going to talk books. We're going to talk classic fiction. We're going to talk current fiction. We're going to talk current books on social issues. We're going to talk essays. We're going to talk magazine articles. We're going to talk about books on history. We're going to talk about biographies. And we're also going to talk about my favorite poetry. Of course, the goal of JBL is for people to get back in the habit of reading printed books. Studies show that the human mind is made stronger and healthier by reading a book versus reading on an electronic device such as a tablet or even an iPhone. It is proven that young children who read books retain more information when reading a book than when reading on an electronic device. But here is the only thing that I require. And that is, you're going to have to start reading. Even more, I want you to start developing the habit of reading and love it. You know what this means? This means you're going to have to turn off your television and start reading. This means you're going to have to stop going to so many movies. This means you're going to have to get off your iPad or your smartphone and start reading. And I want you to read books. I want you to just take the book in your hand. I want you to be able to touch the pages. I want you to be able to smell it. I want you to be able to have an experience with it. And all of that brings me to the subject of our very first program. Let me tell you what I've been reading lately. Here's the title of the book. Its title is Lit Up, One Reporter, Three Schools, 24 Books That Can Change Lives. And it's by author David Denby. Now, Denby is a staff writer, and he's a former film critic for The New Yorker. His reviews, essays have appeared in The New Republic, The Atlantic, and The New York Magazine. So, like me, he's been around a while, and he's been writing quite a bit. But the reason he wrote this book is he is really concerned about what is happening to teenagers, especially those between the ages of 17 and 18. And what he's discovered is teenagers at that age just do not like reading. And in fact, one teenager told him, "Books smell like old people."
Wow. I didn't realize I sounded so intense on that early program. But as a literature instructor, I am very passionate about students and adults' need for reading. Over the next several programs, I discussed how reading benefits young children, teenagers, and adults. And remember, you can go back to these programs and hear them again. They're all listed for you on kpcg.fm. Now, the first two books that we discussed on JBL were The Old Man and the Sea and the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. And I cheated a little bit. I was able to use my lectures from our college sophomore English class, and I got the factual information from those lectures. I also got points of discussions that we had actually had in class. So, in fact, I even invited several college students and Imperial Academy instructors to participate in some of my panel discussions. So, after I got my feet wet on radio, I stepped out of the water and flew across the pond and took JBL on the road to Stratford-upon-Avon, England. Now, that was exciting. I plan to do a handful of programs in England as an introduction to JBL's Summer of Shakespeare series. Now, with the help of Richard Palmer, who lives over in England, I pitched the Royal Shakespeare Company to allow me to interview two of their young and upcoming actors, Papa Essadieu and Natalie Simpson, who were then featured in their production of Shakespeare's Hamlet. This was an exciting beginning to doing interviews on JBL. Last night, I want to be able to tell you that I was able to attend the RSC performance of Shakespeare's Hamlet, and two actors from the performance have graciously agreed to be here. They're taking time out of their busy rehearsal schedule. They have another performance tonight, and I'll just tell you now, I'm going back tonight. So, anyway, they are here to talk to us about Hamlet. With me today is Papa Essadieu. He has the title role of Hamlet. And I also have with me Miss Hamlet. Miss, excuse me. That's being 64 and jet-lagged. But I have Natalie Simpson with me, and she has a title role of Ophelia. So welcome to The Best Literature. Melanie Phillips had a great article in The Times, May 10th of is it still May? It is still May, yes. And she gave really high praise to the Royal Shakespeare Company because, first of all, the Royal Shakespeare Company has a high value on education and educating people about Shakespeare. Here's one of the quotes that she said, and I don't want to get into, you know, any politics here, but she does say about Shakespeare, she says, "Shakespeare doesn't need cuts or additions or transgendered trapeze artists gyrating in hot pants to David Bowie. In Shakespeare's plays, the words are everything." And I have to agree with Miss Phillips, and that's what I really try very hard to work with and with my students is to teach them that's everything. I mean, it's the poetry. Mm-hmm. It's the poetry that you want. And of course, I just want to tell you last night that, you know, I've kind of hooked on the Branagh film because we use it a lot. You know, when I do make the students read in class, they have to read on their own. I mean, we're talking 19, 20-year-olds. But I really try and stress with them, look, it's the poetry you want to get into. Mm-hmm. It's the understanding that Shakespeare is trying to communicate. And I have to say, I was really moved to tears last night with your performance, both of you. And it was the words. I mean, Papa, you were so clear, and the diction was so clear, and it was really easy to follow it. And, you know, some of the actors will go so fast, and I know there's got to be pressure on you guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the thing that I'd like to do is just, you know, let's talk about the poetry, and let's talk about how it's impacted you. I mean, doing Hamlet, that's got to be, like, the role that any Shakespearean actor would want. And you have it, yeah. And you're just you're commanding it. And of course, I've did some research before I came over. But so they don't want to hear me; they want to hear how is doing Hamlet and all the poetry impacted your life?
Playing Hamlet is it kind of feels like being in the 12-round bout of Mike Tyson. 6 times a week, you know,
like
you come out the other end and you feel kind of like you've been knocked from pillar to post, and it's difficult, and it requires a lot of kind of physical, vocal, mental, emotional, psychological preparation to be able to do it. You can't just jump into it. For example, we started off doing a 5-week run of this play, and then I fortunately had a month off whilst half the cast rehearsed another play, Cymbeline, and then I had to come back into it after being away from it for a month. And I was like, hey man, I've done it for 5 weeks, it's all in my body's in my mind. I walked on and there was nothing. Nothing. It was kind of like trying to walk on your hands. So yeah, it's really difficult, and it really requires huge preparation. But the language, as you quite pertinently pointed out, is the key to it. I mean, I think like Shakespeare is a genius when it comes to linguistic skill, but I think Hamlet is kind of like his piece de resistance in that sense.
I really, you know, when I look at Hamlet, of course, I was a lit major all the way back in the 70s, so I remember sitting in lit class, and of course, we had to pass a 4-credit Shakespeare class before they'd give us our degree, you know, so it was not easy. But I remember sitting in class going through these plays saying, what are they talking about? You know, of course, now that I've had some life experience, all that, I understand it better. But what's it like doing the soliloquies? I mean, they're so instructive. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think about it or do you think about it before you get up there? I mean, you have to understand it to be able to portray what you portrayed last night.
Fully. Like, I try not to think about it before I do it because that will take that takes away from the immediacy of the connection to the language what you're saying and their connection with the audience. Because, I mean, like, soliloquies are essentially just conversations with audience members.
Oh,
that's what I feel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Like, if there's a question in the soliloquy, you're asking it without knowing that there's going to be an answer. So I could ask, am I a coward, for example? And I'd hope that someone would tell me either I am or I'm not. But if not, then that pushes me on to the next question. Who calls me villain? So, I mean, like, I think that kind of helps it. But, I mean, these soliloquies are just mad because they're so well known in terms of English literature or English language literature. It's kind of like the kind of greatest hits.
But, you know, it's something, I don't know if you'd agree with me. You've done certainly a lot more. But don't you feel sometimes that Shakespeare is actually Hamlet, that he's writing for himself?
I don't know.
That's what I do to my students. This is what I do to them.
I remember someone wrote that Hamlet is a play written by a genius about a genius. So if that's, I mean, it's obviously a very personal play because his son was called Hamlet. His son
that's died right.
was called Hamlet. That's right. And this is a play about a son avenging a father's death. So there's a kind of like mirror image kind of thing in there.
So the thing is, one of my favorites, it's not really necessarily a soliloquy, but when he's talking with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, after the, you know, of course, Claudius is trying to cover his neck and, yeah. you know, brings them there because he wants to find out what's really going on in Hamlet's mind. It's all a big ruse. But then he goes in, he breaks into what a piece of work is man, you know, how long. So he, it's like, can you imagine Shakespeare writing this? It's like, I kind of imagine this is what he's wondering. You know, here we are. Here we have human beings. You know, and he brings us out in other soliloquies. We have this great discourse. We have these minds. We can reason. And yet we can get into such terrible messes sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, here's Hamlet. He was a brilliant. I mean, according to the story, of course, you know, it's based on history anyway. But here he's at Wittenberg. He was studying philosophy. He was a very, very well-educated man. Mm-hmm. Probably more ready to take over the throne than certainly Claudius was. And he certainly knew Claudius was a ditz compared to his own dad. Mm. So it's. I mean, it took a lot of genius to put so much detail in the story, and then let's just transfer to Natty a little bit because you get enough on stage. So how do you feel playing Ophelia? I mean, it's probably one of the most dramatic female roles that you could play.
I think playing Ophelia has had more of an emotional effect on me than I maybe anticipated. When I first started doing some research into the character, Simon and I, decided to get some women from this charity called Mind, and they basically support women with manic depression, bipolar, psychoses. And we spoke to them about what we thought Ophelia was going through, actually, not just madness, but something that's tangible. And we looked at kind of her symptoms, what she was saying, what she was doing, how she was acting. We decided on manic depression with some episodes of like psychoses, like she's having a bit of a psychotic break. And I think through talking, I mean, I spoke to them for hours and kept in touch with them by email afterwards. And I did a lot of research myself online, watched a few documentaries. And that, I think, coupled with having kind of experiences with people in my life that have mental issues, I think it really opened something in me. Especially to have to go into a place where I do at the end in that madness scene, it's kind of recognizing some things in yourself where you're like, wow, I think everyone has, under extreme stress, everyone has the capacity to break a little bit. Everyone does. And I think that's what kind of shook me a little bit.
I thought you did a great job. I mean, the one thing is, like I said, I felt like you were real. I mean, it was like I said, you see a film, they're kind of flat. I mean, even, I don't care how much color you have, I don't care how much, you know. But when you're actually in the theater, and we're really pretty close, I mean, we're really pretty, even though we might be sitting in the upper level, we're still pretty close to you. And you really were able to communicate the feeling of this poor girl. You do feel for her. And even like with the queen, she doesn't want to see her. And I'm thinking, well, why don't you want to see her? She needs help. So I thought you did a great job of that, and but it really showed the stages. Both of you showed the stages of what these characters go through. You know, Hamlet, he thinks he's, you know, calls himself a lily-livered pigeon, and he's grappling with this. You know, he's grappling with, is the ghost, is he a demon? You know, or is this really a spirit that could help me? You know, he doesn't come to those conclusions right away, but we find him transferring. And then here you see this Ophelia in love with her father, you know, obviously in love with Hamlet. Obviously they're, you know, she's ready to just begin her life. Mm. And then this tragedy happens. Her father's killed. You know, the love of her life tells her, I never did love you, which is a lie. And then what really got to me the most is here, you know, Laertes is putting the facsimile of you in the grave. Mm-hmm. And then Hamlet finally admits, I loved her, and yet you never heard it.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was just a great, great, I don't know, it really communicated it to me. And I thought, mm-hmm. have you ever thought about, have you learned anything from Ophelia that you could transfer to maybe people that you know have depression? Have you learned something? I mean, it's really...
Yeah. I would say it's interesting to note that when people... Because with Ophelia, what I realize is that she cracks because she feels immense guilt. She feels that because she listened to her dad and she decided to end things with him, Hamlet went crazy. He then turned on her, became violent with her, abusive. You know, they became abusive. He then goes and kills her father. So she thinks, okay, so my father's death is on me. His treatment is on me. So I think it's interesting to note, to think, or to realize that sometimes when you get to this state where you're so broken, it's all about blaming things on yourself. And sometimes it's good to get an understanding of the whole picture and to not sit there and blame yourself and take everything on yourself, because that's when you kind of implode.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think. So anyway, I just thought it was a great portrayal, and you know, she's a great character.
Now, also while on that trip, I was able to do a program at Hampton Court, one of King Henry VIII's residences. It is likely that Shakespeare did many of his plays in the indoor theater there for Queen Elizabeth I. I also did A Man on the Street near Shakespeare's birthplace, taped a program at the Battle of Bosworth Field related to Shakespeare's play Richard III, which we also did on JBL. This famous battle was vitally important for both England and America.
I'm standing here on Ambition Hill. We're in the county of Leicestershire. And I have with me Mr. Richard Palmer, who many of you know is one of our staff writers for the Philadelphia Trumpet. And he's here to help me understand this incredible history. And so, Richard, just looking over the battlefield, it's really quite amazing. Could you tell us, why is the Battle of Bosworth not only important to our understanding of the play Richard III, but what is the importance for us historically?
Well, the Battle of Bosworth, it's really the climax of the whole tetralogy, the whole series of four books. It ends here. Everything that we've been talking about with Shakespeare gets resolved right here at Bosworth, the Battle of Bosworth Field. But then more of that, more importantly, this is really a crucial battle in the history of England, in the history of America even, and the history of the world. I think it's an interesting example of a battle that didn't really seem all that important at the time when the battle was first fought. You know, we've talked about a whole load of different battles. There's a whole load of different battles mentioned in the Shakespeare books. There's some battles that even aren't mentioned. So at the time, you know, it's another battle, not necessarily a big deal. And that's one of the challenges, actually, of standing here, is there wasn't a whole, not really many people went away and wrote down exactly where the battle took place. So it's been a bit of a challenge for historians to piece together a lot of those details, because at the time it wasn't seen as important. In hindsight, this was huge. This battle finished the Wars of the Roses. It finished this period of civil war that Shakespeare built all of these plays around, and it established a brand new dynasty of kings, the Tudors.
Yeah, let me just interject here. If you have to remember back to all of our listeners out there, that actually the War of the Roses begins with Bolingbroke, or Henry IV, and that's really in that first tetralogy. It starts with Richard II, and of course we know that that Shakespeare is working with us, and he's bringing up these incredible issues of government and lineage and the importance of who is most appropriate to be king. And, you know, there is, in England, there's always this line of succession, and who is the rightful king. And we know from Richard II that he was not qualified to rule, and yet Henry Bolingbroke or Henry IV, he was more qualified, but he actually usurped the throne, and it caused a lot of problems. So now we're coming back to the end of that, and here we are at the very end of this whole
series of events that happened. And of course, Henry, once he took over the throne, he just had a disaster within the country of civil strife. And of course, Henry V was able to somehow resolve that. But still, the problem still kept getting worse, even with his son, Henry VI. And so here you have Richard III, who actually also usurps the throne in a way, taking it from his nephew. And so it is kind of interesting that here we do get some resolution. So Richard, let's talk some of the details about this battle. Give us some ideas about the numbers of men that were here. Give us a little bit of the history of the two family lines are here. Of course, the Yorks and Lancastrians were related anyway. And of course, there's some other intrigue there. And so give us some of these details.
So really on this battlefield, there are three sides in a way. You have Richard III, obviously the king. He has by far the largest army, about 10,000 men. He has come up from London. We are very close to the main road up from London that has been the main road up from London since Roman times. On the opposite side, you have Henry Tudor. In the play, he is called Richmond. He goes on to become Henry VII. So a lot of different names for the same person. That's one of the things that makes keeping up with some of Shakespeare's history in this area so challenging. And so you've got Henry. He's come up. He was exiled in France. He landed in Wales. He's been marching through Wales, accumulating supporters. And now he faces Richard. And then you have a third force on the field, the Stanleys, the Stanley brothers, Thomas and William Stanley. They have about 7,000 men under their command, and they haven't shown their hand yet. They're sitting off on the sides. So to start kind of orientating us around the battlefield, like I said, there's still some debate as to exactly where it happened. Before we get that, actually, one of the really fascinating things to me that stands out coming and visiting Bosworth and talking about the battlefield is just how much things have changed over time. The dominant feature kind of in front of us as we look down the hill is this huge wood. And we tend to think of forests as being these great ancient things. When the Battle of Bosworth took place, that forest wasn't there. It completely obscures our view of what would have been the battlefield from up here. But it wasn't there back in those days. So the generally accepted order of battle, just a bit further down this hill, Richard had his forces. He had divided his forces into three. That was pretty common back then. He had those in the front under Norfolk. He was in the middle, and then he had his rear guard commanded by Northumberland. Then coming towards the bottom of the hill, coming up the hill, was Henry. Coming up the hill, generally that's the weaker position. However, Henry had to his right a marsh. Again, it's not a marsh today. It's further down the hill. We can't see it because of the forest. And he was coming up the hill, and in command of his troops was the Earl of Oxford. That Henry wasn't a very experienced military commander, so he delegated control of his army to Oxford. Instead of splitting his smaller force into three, the way that would have been typical, he concentrated his forces. He kept them together. And then we mentioned a third force looking kind of across the valley. There's a group of buildings nestled in some trees over the other side. That is roughly, probably, where the Stanleys would have had their force. So they were standing a bit off.
So there's really quite a lot of distance between them. So how many forces would, let's say, Henry VII or Henry Tudor or Richmond? We have to get all those names straight, and it is kind of interesting. Richard's really helping me do that. But how many forces would Henry have had with him?
He had about 5,000. I think from what we can tell, he landed from France with around 2,000-ish. A lot of those were French mercenaries. Then, as he marched through Wales, he would have accumulated a lot of Welsh support. The Tudor's roots go to Anglesey in North Wales and to Wales in general. On his banner is the big Welsh lion. And even you get some of those Welsh roots of the House of Lancaster in general are brought out in Henry V and some of his conversations with Threnin. So you've got that that Welsh support, and then he would have also gained support from English nobles who were with him in France and who were rallying to his cause now that he had landed. So about 5,000 men.
I think it might be good to point out here, too, that when Henry came from France, of course, he is Richmond, but we will refer to him as Henry Tudor. When he came from France, he actually came from Harfleur. And for those of you that love Henry V, you know there's that famous battle at Harfleur where Henry says to his troops, he inspires them, he says, into the breach once more. Now, that's not an exact quote, but those of you that really know your Shakespeare know what I'm talking about.
Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more into the breach, or close up the wall with our English dead. In peace, nothing so becomes a man as modesty. That's about all I know.
All right, quit showing off. But, you know, you have to understand, Richard is trained in British schools, and I'm sure you had to memorize that.
I had to memorize that soliloquy in, I think, about fifth or sixth grade, and I've forgotten most of it.
Yeah, well, that's still good to hear that. But anyway, it is interesting. So what about Stanley's troops? How many would have Stanley have had with him?
So Stanley has about 7,000, which, I mean, that illustrates something we've seen throughout this period, that you've got Sir Thomas Stanley, Constable of England. He's not even a lord, but he has an army that's nearly the same size as the king's. And that has been a major feature throughout these wars, that the lords can command very powerful armies. And his army is really even bigger than Henry. So he's the deciding factor in a lot of ways. Whoever he supports will have the largest army of the day.
Yeah, and so that's why Henry IV or Bolingbroke could have actually taken the throne from Richard II, because he would have had a better standing army being one of the lords. And so it really is a different kind of history you need to understand to really understand Shakespeare's plays. But so when you understand the number of people or the number of soldiers, then actually the area looks quite small.
It is. It's still a relatively small battle. I mean, the Wars of the Roses weren't quite the same as some of the huge battles that go on in Europe. So it's not necessary. It's still a relatively small affair, as battles go. It is hard to visualize today just what those crowds would look like, but. You know, just by way of comparison, the famous protests in Tahrir Square in Egypt, they were talking about there being 1 million men there. So it's actually not, and you would regularly get more than those number of men at like a football game or a basketball game. A lot of stadiums can seat more than that. So it isn't necessarily that huge a crowd. And that's one of the reasons why the Battle of Bosworth wasn't really seen as that important at the time. You had the Battle of Taunton up north. Quite a few years earlier, far more people died there, far more people fought there. So it's quite a small number of men for such a significant battle.
We were able to tape this program on a beautiful summer day in the lush English countryside. It was an amazing paradox to think of the blood that was spilled on such a beautiful land. Here is the explanation of why this battle is so important.
Well, this was the battle that really established the Tudors. It ended these decades of infighting, and it allowed England to start to grow. And you know, the Tudors come along, and they start to address some of the real underlying causes of the Wars of the Roses. So one of the things they do is they get rid of all of these nobles having these massive standing armies, and they centralize power in London, in the state. They centralize power around the king. So England really goes from being this kind of medieval state, semi-feudal state, to being something that resembles much more closely a modern, unified, unitary state. And you've got to remember, if you go back to Henry IV and some of the parts back there, the Percys and some of the people rebelling against Henry IV are trying to actually break up England and create kind of a new kingdom of Greater Northumbria in the north. And what the Tudors do is they make this unimaginable. England is now one state, one center of power. There's no chance of breaking it into smaller units. They really unify it. So that's mainly the result of Henry VII and Henry VIII. They also really, Henry VII, he was one of these kind of boring kings. He wasn't necessarily eccentric, but he did a lot of really solid work on things that aren't really exciting, you know, making reforms, encouraging trade, And so prosperity, England starts to flourish. You get a lot more prosperity now that these wars are over. Then you start to get into Henry VIII. He makes some of the biggest decisions in English history. You know, he breaks off from Rome, and you have the Protestant Reformation, something that's huge for the whole history of the world, or the English Reformation, sorry. And then under the Tudors, you have England joins the Age of Exploration. England starts sending long-range ships around the world. They go across the Atlantic. They start colonizing America. They start what's sometimes called the First British Empire with its colonies over in North America. And so without Bosworth cementing this dynasty, really setting them up in place, England would be a radically different place. But even the colonization of America, you know, if it weren't for the Battle of Bosworth, perhaps that would have been undertaken by the Spanish or by the French. And so it's an absolute, by cementing this dynasty that was so crucial in taking England out from the medieval area and into the Enlightenment and into the Renaissance, you would have a radically different world without the aftermath of this battle where we're standing today.
Well, that's just fascinating. One of the things I might just interject here just to help fill in the details, it's also important to remember that Henry the Seventh, and this was Richmond, this is the man that wins at the end of Richard III, is Elizabeth I's grandfather. And so you bring this whole line in, and Richard was just mentioning, you know, that about the empire. And really, Elizabeth I was, you know, ruling over that. And, you know, she was really one who, well, certainly she fostered Shakespeare. She really supported Shakespeare. And, of course, some of his plays, his history plays, are there to show, you know, certainly the greatness of the Tudors. He does have a whole play devoted to Henry VIII, and you know, it is quite interesting.
After finishing JBL's lengthy Shakespeare series, we moved into discussing some current books of fiction and nonfiction. Close to the 2016 presidential election, we tackled a controversial book, 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened at Benghazi. But then we moved into a new fiction work by Austrian author Robert Seethaler, A Whole Life. This beautifully written novella is the story of Andreas Egger, a simple but wise mountain man, and the experiences he went through during his whole life. Now, after that, we moved into the genre of memoirs. We tackled H is for Hawk, and that's by Helen MacDonald. And it really was an unusual memoir, but it was really fascinating, and a lot of our listeners actually enjoyed it. But I think the most pleasurable book to read and discuss in this section was Thad Carhart's wonderful memoir, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank. Now, Ryan Malone, host of Music for Life, joined with me to discuss the subject of choosing a piano, which Carhart talks about in his memoir. Well, welcome, Ryan.
Thanks so much for having me.
One thing I also want to say is Ryan is also our concert manager for our Armstrong Foundation Performing Arts Series, and it's really a great series. He is an accomplished pianist. He has performed on our exquisite Armstrong Auditorium stage. And one thing that most people may not know about Ryan, he is the man with his one of his assistants, Mark Jenkins. He had the incredible opportunity of going to Germany and picking out one of our two Steinway pianos that we feature on our stage. And if you've been reading this book, you know that Carhart talks a lot about choosing a piano, or does a piano choose you? And so I'd like to start out, Ryan, if you don't mind. Let's talk a little bit about that. What was it like to go to Germany and pick out a Steinway? I can't imagine anything greater for a pianist.
it was fantastic. Of course, traveling in its own right, but then going to the Steinway factory, getting the grand tour before you go into the piano selection room. They show you around. They let you take pictures. There's one room they say no cameras in here. It has some of their patented things they do. And then we get into the piano room. We had six Model D concert grands. Model D is the 9-foot. We had six of them all in a row, and there were probably about five or six times as many pianos in that room, but we only looked at those first six. Those were the only ones of that size. And so those were all the same brand, and those were all the same size, but yet they were all different. And I really did relate to what Carhart talks about in his book. Now, he was looking at all sorts of different nationalities of pianos and even brands and things like that. And even, well, will it be this size or that size? So we had it narrowed down, but even then, each piano was completely unique.
So did the studio look like Luke's Atelier?
No, it wasn't all everything. This was a showroom, more like, if you would imagine a showroom where pianos are just, they were more lined up in, say, three columns of pianos. And right as you walked in, closest to the door, the first column on the left had the 6 9-foot Steinways. And so those were the ones we were housed at for the next, you know, half a day, just picking them.
So how long did it take you to decide this is the piano? You know, Carhartt spends a lot of time on how to pick pianos. So.
Right. Well, now, we were in a little different situation where we had, the piano was basically purchased. We just had to pick the one. And that's pretty common for concert halls to have someone go representing the hall, knowing what the hall is like and what the needs of the program are, so that they can pick the perfect piano for the program. But I felt like we picked a perfect piano, as perfect as a piano can be, not just for our hall, but it took a few hours, well, a couple hours even, just to land on the one. You know, Mark and I both were secretly making notes about the 6 pianos, not sharing with each other. And he's got a great poker face, and I didn't know which one he was leaning toward. Maybe he knew which one I was leaning toward, but I got to the one we picked last, and he had started on that one, so we kind of were going in opposite directions. So when I got to that one, I think he saw me perk up, and he had his notebook, and he said, "Yeah, this is the one that I've been." Basically, it was like we said, 1, 2, 3, pick the one, point to the one you like, and we pointed to the same one. So, which was really amazing. It took a couple hours, and then we spent a couple hours just playing the snot out of it. You know, we just had to like try everything. We came prepared with all sorts of repertoire. That was even going over there. We practiced a lot on music, because we were trying to come with a variety of repertoire. So then we really played that one piano and made sure then, after we both knew the preference, that this was in fact the one, that it was consistent all the way up and down.
So I'm assuming that when you went over there, you know what kind of concerts we've already had here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can name a few for people.
So,
you know, the famous pianists we've had here.
Right. So. Yeah. We had Andre Watts here. We've got the Eroica Trio coming up in a few weeks. And, you know, that features the piano very heavily. Yes. And so this was actually even before Armstrong Auditorium opened, but we had the series. And so we had the series in another building on campus, and we were going to use that. We weren't going to have that piano until the building opened.
The building opened, right.
But we were selecting it with the vision in mind.
Because I know when Andre Watts came, I mean, there's some really great things in the book where, you know, they compare the clavichord and the harpsichord and the mm-hmm. piano, and how when the piano was first invented, it was like the boilermaker of the harpsichord. You mm-hmm. know, you know, it was seen as an instrument you could bang on.
Right.
But when Andre Watts came, that's exactly what he did the piano.
Right.
I mean, he did bang on it, but the music that came out was astounding.
Right.
So did you actually go there with the idea that you would have like really loud music and then really soft music? And so
right. Well, it's funny because they even said there are some Russian pianists who they all want it to be loud. They want the piano to just be loud, and they said they're looking for the piano that's a trumpet. You know, and they were salesmen, so they made us feel really good about what we were selecting. But they said, well, you know, you guys are looking not just for loudness, but you're looking for that whisper as well. And the piano we found had that variety, so it could, like Carhartt says, you know, the world gets louder as soon as the piano comes on the scene. But then it also could just get down in that hush. That Armstrong Auditorium has that crisp acoustic for, you know, just a small recital hall. And so you can have the roar and you can have the whisper, and it's all in the same. Even like what he said in the book, he used that metaphor of like from thunder to whisper, you know, that's the kind of range that this piano has.
Yes. Well, it is amazing. One of the things that I just wanted to bring out in terms of Steinway, the thing that Carhartt brings out, and you can correct me if I've read this wrong, but I was really surprised that one of the biggest centers to make Steinways was actually the United States
mm-hmm.
years ago. I mean, I always thought you had to go to like Germany to find the Steinway.
Right.
but...
Well, they were an American family. They were of German heritage, but they were an American family that started that company. And then when they opened the German factory, there's things that the Germans do, like Luke in here says, I consider Hamburg Steinway as a German piano, because the Germans have perfected that particular craft in a special way, in different ways than the New York pianos. So, yeah, it was American in its origination, but yet, you know, it's morphed, you know, with the German accent there.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about, you know, he talks about the uniqueness of pianos, and again, I love my piano music, and I have my favorites, and, you know, when I'm reading or writing or studying, I always have classical music going on in my earbuds, you know, so mm-hmm. that just seems like it relaxes my brain that I can actually think. So I know Carhartt brings some things out in the book. Could you, like, you know, maybe talk a little bit about how these nationalities make these individual pianos?
Well, he does talk about that early on in the book, pages 18 and 19. He's talking about, well, the French prefer anything French, and he talks about even a Ukrainian piano and a Russian piano and the German pianos and that type of thing, and just the different priorities that those makers put on. It can get pretty technical, but I think he gives a really nice overview of just how you're dealing with so many different parts. You know, like he says, in one sense, it's a pretty simple concept: press, key, hear, sound. But then he says, but the particulars, you know, the particulars become quite complicated. And so, you know, like even in a Steinway, when you're dealing with 12,000 pieces of wood, you know, you're talking about trees from all over that have all sorts of different lifespans. And so even in those six Steinways that were supposedly identical, they're all handmade. And so, you know, the guy doing this part and the guy doing that part, they're two different people. They could have two different days when they're making two different pianos, and it could be slightly different. And so even the uniqueness of one piano is astounding. But then, yeah, you get into the nationalities, and it's even, you know, it's even more diverse.
So do you think, like, that when you pick a piano, is it just more subjective? I mean, to the person that's going to own it, or is it like you had to really? It's kind of like you had to pick a piano that would be interesting for all the
right.
all the audiences that are coming.
And all the repertoire that'd be performed and all the different kinds of ways the piano right. would be approached. And so we had to find really the catch-all piano. It chooses you, you know, when you...
yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. Did it choose
yes,
you? Did the Steinway
well,
choose you?
because of what we were looking for, because we needed something with so much range, you know, in that sense. So it really did. It stood out in that way. Now, someone, like he said, well, you know, a Russian pianist might pick this piano because, wow, it's just got a really, really, it's got a brassier sound, and it can really cut through the orchestra when you play those opening chords of the Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto or something like that. So we, you know, someone might be looking for something in a smaller hall or a bigger hall, or it's almost always going to be played with an orchestra, or it'll never be played with an orchestra. Those considerations, certain things about the piano jump out at you and let you know that this is the one for you.
Yet I think the most interesting book of our memoir series was Peter Hessler's memoir, Country Driving, A Chinese Road Trip. Now, it's not just a road trip. It's really about China. But Peter was gracious enough to grant me an interview about his time living in China. So, Peter, welcome to JBL.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So today, basically what I do, Peter, is I just want to... talk a little bit about you, yourself, and then I also want to know, well, the reason why you wrote the book, and then, of course, what we want to know most of all is we want to know about China that probably most of us will never have the opportunity to see firsthand. So that's my little roadmap. We'll call it like driving JBL. How about that?
Sounds good.
Okay. So I know a little bit of the background because, I've done some reading on you. But maybe you could just start out and tell us how you came to be in China and why did you start writing about China?
Yeah, I mean, China wasn't something I thought about when I was young. I mean, you know, I grew up in, I was in high school in the late 1980s. And then I was in college from 88 to 92. And, you know, that was a time when it wasn't very common to study Chinese or to think about China. I grew up in Columbia, Missouri. So my horizons weren't really that far. I went to college on the East Coast and never took a class in Chinese or in Chinese history and really didn't have much interest in it. And of course, when I was in college was when the Tiananmen Square massacre happened in 1989. And that made it even less likely, I think, for Americans to really engage with China.
That's right. Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about that later. And I'm sorry for interrupting, but go ahead.
Yeah, no. So I was focused, you know, what I really wanted to be was a writer. I originally thought I was going to go to graduate school, get a PhD, and maybe be a professor of literature, and write on the side, write fiction. So that was what I was planning to do. After college, I went to graduate school at Oxford University in England. And during those 2 years, I realized that I didn't want to go into academia, and I realized I didn't want to study literature anymore. I still wanted to write, though, and I wasn't sure how I was going to do that. And so I thought, well, let's take a long trip, see some of the world, and think about what the next step will be. And so I left England. That was in 1994, and I got a one-way plane ticket to Prague in the Czech Republic. And from there, I traveled overland, either by train or bus or eventually by boat. And I went to Russia, and then from Russia, I took the Trans-Siberian Railroad all the way from Moscow to Beijing, which was a seven-day trip. Really an amazing experience. And so that was how I got to China. I was really just heading east, going home around the world in the wrong direction. And after China, I was planning to go to Southeast Asia. And really, I didn't have any intention to stay in China for very long because I heard from other travelers that it was a pretty tough place. But once I arrived in Beijing, and that would have been about August of 94, there was just a real tangible energy to it. And something about it really grabbed me. I mean, I just, you know, we had come from Russia. I was traveling with a friend. And our experience in Russia had been that the place felt pretty depressed. So those were tough times in Moscow. And we got to Beijing, and people were just – you could just see people were motivated. Things were happening, and I got really fascinated. And I ended up spending about 6 weeks traveling on that trip. And by the end of that trip, I decided I want to come back to China. I want to live here. I want to try to learn the language. Now I thought, you know, how can I do this? And so my decision was to join the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps had a new program in China at that point. And I was sent there as a volunteer. I was in the third group of volunteers, and so I was sent to a small town called Fuling, in the interior of China along the Yangtze River. This was a town that hadn't had any American residents since the Revolution of 1949.
Wow.
So really isolated. There was one other American sent with me, and other than that, we were on our own.
So did you didn't know Chinese then? Before.
Not a word. No, I had not studied Chinese, and this is a disadvantage, but in some ways it's also, my mind was a great open, great blank slate. I didn't have any prejudices about China. I think I didn't have any real expectations. I didn't have fixed ideas of what the place should be. And in some ways that was very useful because things were changing very rapidly. The China that you would have studied in the 80s and early 90s was not the same China that I arrived in 1996. Yeah. So it was good to be sort of flexible. And the language came pretty quickly because, I was in this town. There was one other native English speaker. and also because there were a few people in the town who could speak decent English. They learned it from listening to Voice of America and, listening to tapes and really impressive people. But they were actually, for political reasons, the Communist Party prevented them from hanging out with us. So, if I was going to have any kind of social life, I had to learn Chinese. So I studied like crazy. And, of course, we had no internet connection either, so we had lots of time on our hands.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is when I was in college, I did the literature degree, but I also took a minor in fine arts. And one of the classes that I took it on Chinese art, especially from the Ming Dynasty. So I was really fascinated by China. But it was one of those things that a lot of my friends were Jewish at that time. A lot of where I went, I started school, started the University of Pittsburgh at the Johnstown campus, and a lot of the students came from Philadelphia. A lot of the Jewish students came from Philadelphia, and we seemed to connect really well. And we all had the dream. This was in 75 of, you know, going and working on a kibbutz, you know. So so that would have taken me a much different direction than China. But I've always had this fascination with China and wanting to learn more about it. But it was kind of it seemed like a scary place, you know, to me. It's like, you know, in our minds, I think we had all these things floating around, you know, a little bit of fear of Mao, you know, and then.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, it was a pretty tough place. And of course, you couldn't have gone in there in 1975 anyway. I mean, Americans didn't start to come until after the reforms began. And it really, you know, to be honest, I was very fortunate because even 5 years earlier, if I had gone to China, I couldn't have lived in a remote place like Fuling, and people wouldn't have been very open to me. There were still a lot of restrictions, but this was the first moment when you could actually kind of connect. And so I did end up, and I was there for 2 years in that town. I was able to learn the language and to make very good friends and really to get to know people on a very, very deep personal level. And so this wouldn't have been possible for people of an earlier generation.
No, it is really kind of amazing. That leads me to another question. We just got finished reading Thad Carhart's book, the Piano Shop on the Left Bank. I don't know if you're familiar with that book at all, but
no, I'm not actually. Is it about Paris? Or?
It's about Paris. Yeah, he was living in one of the small neighborhoods of Paris, and Thad is also a freelance writer. He worked in business like I did for years, and then he decided he wanted to break out on his own. And at one point, I tried to do that as well, and I was going broke, so I realized I better, you know, better not do this. But anyway, what he talks about in that book is he talks about how hard it is to make connection with the French, and it's not because, you know, they're just so snobbish or they're, you know, so uppity. It's just because, well, you know, they're just very respectful of people and they're respectful of their private space. But he was able to break through the piano. And so that was like one of the big questions. I think it would be good for our listeners after we just finished this other book is, was it really hard for you to make connection with the people?
It's an interesting question. And I mean, Paris, the other thing about Paris is there's so many foreigners that go through Paris and so many tourists and so many expats who live there.
Yes.
That, you know, if somebody, a French person is going to be less interested. I mean, the advantage that I had in a place like Fuling or really anywhere in China in the 90s was that there weren't many foreigners there and very few foreigners spoke Chinese. And so in the town where I lived, I mean, if I went to a shop or a restaurant, there was constantly a crowd following me, because people were so curious just to see a foreigner. So if I sat down at a noodle restaurant to have lunch, I might have a crowd of 20 people. That was really standard. Just watching, you know, and asking questions. And of course, at the beginning, I didn't really understand what they were saying. It was very frustrating. Sometimes it was intimidating, annoying. But, you know, over time, and as my Chinese improved, I realized, you know, these people, they're just really curious. They've been isolated from the world for decades. They just want to connect. They want to ask me questions, and I want to learn Chinese. And so they're here to teach me. You know, that was the way I looked at it. You know, like, let's relax. Don't assume that people are making fun of you or have negative, you know, intentions, and just do your best. And people were very patient with my bad Chinese, and my Chinese very quickly improved. And so once, after about a year, you know, I was getting pretty good at spoken Chinese. And then it was really phenomenal because people were so interested in me as a foreigner, as an outsider, it was really quite easy to connect. And I would be invited to people's homes all the time. You know, and so it was the Chinese in a way, even though they had this reputation for being closed, it was a moment when actually they were very open, because to them, this was a unique opportunity to meet somebody from outside.
Well, it's really fascinating to hear that, because that would be my first impression is, well, if I went there, no one would want to talk to me anyway because I'm American or something like that. But I think it's funny in the book where you bring out, they didn't know what you were. Like, are you Mongolian? You know.
Oh, when I was driving, yeah.
Are you Mongolian?
And they'd ask if I was Uyghur, because the Uyghurs are Turkic people from the far west of China.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
When I was driving across northern China, I was in really remote areas, and these were tiny villages and places where no tourists ever go. And so it was really beyond their conception that a foreigner would show up there. And of course, I was driving a Jeep Cherokee by myself, and I was speaking Chinese. And this was when I lived in Beijing. So by this point, my Chinese was quite good. And so they really didn't. Yeah, I would often pick up a hitchhiker. You know, he or she would sit in the front seat of my car. We would talk for 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. And then finally, the person would kind of look at me and say very politely, are you Chinese? Or, you know, sometimes they say, you're not Chinese, are you? And so it wasn't even the first question. So that was an amazing experience. It made me feel much more connected to the place and much less like a foreigner.
Well, that's really fascinating. I know that, I should say this. I had a similar experience, you know, because I was East Coast. You know what East Coast people are like. You know, Northeasterner. Mm-hmm. And then my wife and I had the opportunity when I had my first job, we went to Pendleton, Oregon. That was like, we were out there, you know, in the Wild West. You know, I was walking down the main street to go to work, and I had my little Irish cap on, and the cowboys and the Indians in the city were just stare at me, you know. And so, but I was mm-hmm. American, but I still felt like a foreigner there. So, and they weren't as interested in, you know, learning about Shakespeare and books and all that either.
So. Yeah.
So did you learn to read Chinese as well?
Yes. Although my reading's not as good as my speaking, but it's, you know, I did a lot of newspaper. I really learned basically to read newspapers because when I became a journalist, that was really important to me. I would have a lot of trouble getting through a novel.
Oh, I bet, yes.
But you know, each type of writing, you know, there's a fairly specific vocabulary to it, and so you can always expand and improve it. That's one of the things I would like to do when I'll probably be living in China again in a couple of years, and I would like to sort of expand my reading abilities. Because once you have the basics of the language, it's not that difficult.
I am planning to do another book, both from Thad Carhart and Peter Hessler, in the future. And I look forward to the possibility of interviewing both authors. Well, it has been an interesting journey over the last 100 programs. We've covered a lot of ground: Hemingway, Franklin, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, Thomas More, and George Orwell. But I even did a series on the King James Bible. In previous programs, I have mentioned the Western literary canon. Now, basically, what that is, it's just a list of books that, let's say, university and college English language literature professors or instructors, librarians, while your top book critics and publishers, they believe that every very well-educated person should read or at least know about the books on this list. Now, it is a list that some consider to be made up of just the best literature. Now, that's where I actually took the title for the program. But actually, I wouldn't necessarily recommend everybody read some of the books on this list. I mean, it's really a very fluid list. It's what some people believe is good. Some of the literature on there I don't think is worth reading. But that's my personal opinion. Now, the Western canon is extensive. And there really are several different versions. That's actually one of the problems with it, because I can make up my own list of Western canon. You can make up your own list, and there are some people that are doing that. They just make up their own list. I think there are some top actresses will just make up their own list, and you read these books. But anyway, Harold Bloom, who used to be a Yale professor of English language literature, he has a list that he published in the year 2000. He published a book that really kind of was very popular and really kind of rocked the higher education world. His list has over 2,500 books on it. Now, he even admits it would take more than one lifetime to try and read 2,500 books on this list. Well, Bloom, he's now 86. He's certainly a very well-respected book critic. He's still writing. He's in the process of just publishing a new book. And he refers to these books as survivors. And so on this Western canon, or the Western canon literary list, books can appear and then they can fall off the list. But I do think it's interesting that he lists the Bible. And now when I talk about the Bible, I'm talking about, you know, more of the Christian version, which is both made up of the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament.
He lists that as the third most important book on the canon. Now, I think that's remarkable. It's a survivor. If you look at the Western canon lists that are on the internet today, it's still at the top. He had an associate. Now, I don't know how well they knew each other, but Professor James Bowers of the University of Nevada. He's also a very well-known professor of English literature. He lists the Bible at the top of the list, if not first on the list. And I think that is really remarkable because it is a survivor. The Bible is probably one of the most important books ever published and ever written in Western society. It's affected all levels of society. It's affected government. It's affected freedoms we enjoy given by constitutions. It speaks out on so many issues, social issues, and it speaks about law and morality, the things that make nations great. But of course, these two men, they just see the Bible as primarily a piece of great literature, which I admit it is. It really is a piece of great literature. You can find all kinds of different kinds of literature in the Bible. You can find prose, you can find poetry. But here at KPCG, we just want you to know that we feel the Bible is far more important than just a piece of literature. We know it to be the Word of God, and that's very important to know. Now, not many people today will necessarily agree with us, and what's to even maybe the greater paradox, there's some people claiming to be Christian don't even agree with that. Now, Harold Bloom has written numbers of books on the Bible, and he does, I think he does reveal some facts. For example, he believes that William Shakespeare actually took some of the ideas for his famous play King Lear. He believes he took it from the book of Job. And as we go through these programs, I'll show you that many of the phrases we use in our language come right out of the Bible. And so he's talked about some things like that. And he still believes the Bible is a very important book, but I don't think Harold Bloom would necessarily say he believes it's the Word of God. He does believe it's just the work of men. So for today's program, this first program on our series, I want to just to begin our discussion of the Authorized King James Bible by looking at some of facts just about the Bible and Bible reading. And then what we'll do is we'll move on to why the Authorized King James Bible is so important. I hope you enjoyed the last 99 programs and are looking forward to the next 100. There's much more to come, so get ready to keep reading. So now we're out of time today, but next time we will be getting back to our 60-plus panel discussion of George Orwell's dystopian horror story, 1984. Now, if you have not yet started reading 1984, there is still time to get into it. We are using the Signet Classics edition. It's available at Amazon.com for about $8. If you're not a Prime member, it's probably going to be $10, but it is still better than buying it at a local bookstore. Of course, you can find used copies of the Signet Classics edition at abebooks.com for about $6. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.